Today is Thursday, April 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
France really has put its, if you like, its weight behind the Libyan National Army, the LNA.
That's Catherine Fields reporting in Paris. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also ahead, Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir is ousted by the military. And the U.S. charges WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in a computer hacking conspiracy linked to the release of hundreds of thousands of secret U.S. documents just hours after British police dramatically arrested him at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the longtime president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, was ousted by the military today after 4 months of mounting demonstrations against his rule. Speaking on national television, Sudan's defense minister, Awad Mohammed Ahmed Ibn Auf, announced what he called the toppling of the regime. He said al-Bashir has been arrested and is in a safe place.
اختلاع ذلك النظام والتحفظ على رأسه بعد اعتقاله في مكان آمن كما أعلن الآتي أولا تشكيل مجلس عسكري انتقالي يتولى إدارة الحكم لفترة انتقالية مدتها عامين.
The defense minister said a transitional military council will run the government for the next 2 years. He also declared a 3-month state of emergency, the suspension of the constitution, and the dissolution of parliament. Tens of thousands of people poured into the streets of Khartoum today to celebrate the president's ouster, dancing and chanting anti-Bashir slogans. Later in the day, some protesters denounced the army statement and said they reject the idea of a military-led ruling council. Well, for more insight into this, we go to South Sudan in Focus reporter Ayan Bior, who was live at the Embassy of Sudan here in Washington. Hello, Ayan.
Hi, Kim. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Well, tell us now, what is going on at the embassy?
Well, Kim, the embassy is open today, but the door is locked. You have to ring to get permission to enter, which may be standard protocol. When I rang the bell, I identified myself as a journalist and requested an interview. I was told no one is available. A while ago, I saw two well-dressed men who arrived in a car with diplomatic plates walk into the Sudanese embassy. Unfortunately, when I asked their driver, he did not tell me which country they represented or what they were doing here. They just left a few minutes ago, but again, I can't speculate why they were here or who they are, but they were here for over half an hour.
Also, I understand there is a lot of social media reaction. So what are people saying?
Yes, in fact, Twitter has been set ablaze with mentions of Sudan. In fact, both Sudan and al-Bashir were trending on my timeline just hours ago. I have to say, from what I've seen, the reaction has been strong. Many online are dismissing the announcement made by the defense minister. One person wrote directly to me on Facebook and said that the army has, quote, stolen their revolution and, quote, exchanged one thief for another. Also, the Sudanese Professionals Association, which is an umbrella group of Sudanese unions who led the protest calling on al-Bashir to step down, wrote on their verified Twitter page that they reject the statement made by the defense minister, and they called on people to maintain sit-ins near the military headquarters.
Also, just looking at the protesters, what are their demands? What do they want?
Well, their demands have been clear. They wanted al-Bashir to step down. And earlier this year, the Declaration of Freedom and Change was signed in Khartoum. It was initiated by the Sudanese Professionals Association and signed by Sudanese opposition forces. That declaration called for the unconditional withdrawal of President Omar al-Bashir and those associated with him, and that is a very important point. It also called for the formation of a national transitional government. The group now says that they will only accept a civilian transitional government. And, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the SPA tweeted out that they rejected the announcement of a transitional military council for 2 years.
Also, what are protesters in the diaspora, what are they saying so far?
Well, you know, I've been covering the protests here in Washington, D.C., as well as New York, since they broke out in late December. And the diaspora, they have been in solidarity with the people in their home country. I can tell you that some of the diaspora members in the states were forced to leave their home country. And the ones that I have spoken to have pointed the finger at President Omar al-Bashir, who they see as a ruthless dictator who created unlivable conditions for them in their home country. Of course, President or former president now, Omar al-Bashir, has maintained his innocence amid these allegations.
Okay, well, thank you so much for giving us this information, and thanks for reporting live there from the Sudan Embassy here in Washington, D.C. That was Ayan Bior reporting live from the Embassy of Sudan in Washington. Well, the founder of the WikiLeaks organization and website, Julian Assange, today appeared in a London court after British police took him out of the Ecuador embassy and arrested him. The judge found him guilty of failing to appear in court 7 years ago when the court was considering a Swedish request to extradite him to face trial on a rape charge. Assange sought asylum in the Ecuador embassy, saying he feared he would be handed over to the United States. Reporter Henry Ridgewell in London has covered the story for VOA. He spoke with my colleague Kate Pound Dawson and says the swiftness of Assange's arrest surprised some people in Britain.
As I said, there were some hints in recent days that Ecuador was moving on this, had enough of Julian Assange in the embassy. The president of Ecuador had said at one stage that having him here was like having a stone in your shoe. And so there was some expectation, but the fact that the police were able to take him away from the embassy in that manner caused some surprise. And there is also some confusion, really, over exactly where the legal process goes from here, because there are separate legal strands that Julian Assange could be facing. Firstly, for breaking the bail terms when he claimed asylum in the UK. But secondly, there is that legal process in Sweden where Julian Assange was facing rape charges that he then claimed asylum from. Now, that legal process was suspended after he was given asylum in the embassy. It's unclear whether that legal process and whether those rape charges will be reinstated and whether he'll face further legal proceedings there. But another twist in this is that Mr. Assange was also arrested under the request of the United States under an extradition arrest warrant on charges of trying to maliciously use computer equipment, i.e. hacking, effectively, and that relates to the huge dump of material, of U.S. Secret Service material that was put on the WikiLeaks website, which Julian Assange co-founded back in 2010 by Julian Assange and by Bradley Manning, now known as Chelsea Manning. So there are these separate legal strands that Julian Assange is facing. It's not clear which of those will take priority, if they will be heard in turn, and whether Mr. Assange might be facing extradition to either Sweden or the United States on these separate charges.
So what will be his immediate fate in the next few hours?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that British authorities won't take the risk again of giving him bail. Back in 2012, when he faced those rape charges in Sweden, he was given bail on the terms where he had to live at a friend's house in the rural countryside in the UK. And during that period of bail, he entered the Ecuadorian embassy and claimed asylum. British authorities won't take that risk again, so it's very likely that he will be remanded in custody. And it's likely that a higher jurisdiction will take on this case within the UK. And we will see what the legal outcome of that will be.
That was journalist Henry Ridgewell explaining the complexities of the Julian Assange case. He was speaking with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. Assange's supporters and media freedom advocates say Ecuador acted illegally in withdrawing asylum for Assange and that his arrest is a threat to press freedom. Well, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appears to be in a good position to gain his fifth term. Benny Gantz, the former military chief of staff, has conceded this week's election. Netanyahu's conservative Likud party and Gantz's blue and white party have equal representation with 35 seats in Israel's parliament. However, early reports suggest that Netanyahu's coalition could hold about 65 seats in the 120-seat Knesset. Our colleague Mario Ritter Jr. spoke with Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem about Netanyahu's historic victory and what happens next as a new government is formed.
How strong is the coalition that Netanyahu is likely to build, and is there a mandate for his leadership?
Yes, there is a mandate for his leadership. 35 seats is actually the best that the Likud party has done under Netanyahu's leadership. In the past, under different prime ministers, they did get a few more. So it's being interpreted very much as a mandate for his leadership. And the right wing and religious bloc, who are his sort of natural allies, brings the total to anywhere between 64 and 67. We don't have final results yet. They're still being counted. But in any case, it's definitely seen as a pretty strong mandate. And now what happens is coalition horse trading. And everybody says, well, I'll join your government if you make me Minister of Defense, or I'll join your government if I get X. And that's what's going on now. Although it's expected that he will successfully form a fairly stable government that will, in fact, look very much like the previous one.
What should we look for in the coming weeks? What can we expect?
Well, first of all, it's going to take several weeks to actually form a government. What happens now is that the president of Israel, Ruvi Rivlin, calls the leader of each party for a meeting and asks them to recommend who they believe should be the prime minister, and the majority will recommend Netanyahu. So we're talking about weeks of coalition negotiations. After that, it's really not clear. Just before the election, Netanyahu did say that he wants to annex parts of the West Bank, which has been under Israeli control since 1967, but has not been annexed, and where about 2.5 million Palestinians live. If he goes ahead with it, that would be a major change in Israeli policy. However, it's not clear if that was more of an election promise or if he's really serious about it. So in any case, it's going to take weeks, if not months.
And finally, what is the reaction? How is the media? How are people reacting?
You know, I think it was pretty much expected. It's not that it was a big surprise. If the result had been different, if Gantz had won, was able to put together a coalition, that would have been a very big story. This is Netanyahu's fifth term. He's slated to become the longest-serving prime minister after David Ben-Gurion, and he'll pass him in July. So it's really being seen as a mandate for Netanyahu, and it didn't seem to matter that there's all these corruption allegations hanging over his head and he could be indicted sometime in the next year. The attorney general has already said that he intends to indict him. So people are definitely seeing it as a victory for Netanyahu and for the right wing in Israel.
Linda Gradstein, thank you for being with us once again.
It's my pleasure.
That was reporter Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem speaking with my colleague Mario Ritter Jr. Among the top stories in the world, India begins the mammoth task of choosing its next government as voters line up at polling booths stretching from Kashmir in the north to eastern and central states. EU leaders agreed to give Britain until October 31st to make its exit from the regional economic bloc, and North Korean state media report Kim Jong-un slams hostile forces that imposed sanctions on his country just hours before the South Korea-U.S. summit in Washington. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Well, amid all the Brexit activity of the EU, little notice is a tiff between Italy and France over how the EU should react to the situation in Libya. Essentially, France blocked a statement that was to be issued by the European Union calling on Khalifa Haftar to pull back his forces. Italy joins the United Nations in supporting the government of national accord led by Fayez al-Sarraj. The EU, Italy in particular, has supported al-Sarraj because of the risk of refugees and migrants using Libya as a staging post to get to the Mediterranean and onto boats to Europe. The EU is trying again today to come up with a united approach to the Libya conflict. Reporter Catherine Field is following the story and spoke with me about the EU's differences over Libya.
France really has put its, if you like, its weight behind the Libyan National Army, the LNA. Now, they've not just put their weight behind that, but also France, don't forget, has got strategic oil assets in eastern Libya. So they're particularly keen that this area stays within its, if you like, its area of influence. It's also given military assistance in the past few years to the Libyan National Army. Now, on top of that, then you have Italy, the former colonial power, and as well a very big player in Libya's oil sector. Now, Libya, is the UN-backed prime minister, is supported by the Italians. So just at a time when the European Union has been calling on restraint, has been generally calling for both sides to get back to the negotiating table, we're seeing the European Union fight amongst itself as to what should be doing. And it got to the point where the European Union couldn't even issue a draft statement on where they thought the Libyan crisis should go. And they couldn't even bring out a statement to say that the civilian population was in danger and calling on restraint. It really has shown that the internal divisions are so deep, despite the fact that both Italy and France have got very strategic reasons for wanting to have a political process in Libya.
Yes, and I understand that France does support Khalifa Haftar, and Italy is supporting the UN-supported Fayez al-Sarraj.
Indeed, and there really doesn't seem to be, if you like, any relationship between France and Italy on this at the moment. They really do seem to be digging in for both sides in the dispute. France particularly needs to keep a commercial hub there. It needs to keep those links there, as does the Italians. At the bottom of all this, too, you have to remember that another reason that both sides need to have some sort of stability in Libya is because of the migrant crisis. They really do not want to see Libya being used any more than it is at the moment as either a jumping off point for Europe or even a transit point for migrants, refugees coming up from other areas in Africa. So even though this escalation of violence and the displacement of people risks a further migrant outpouring from Libya, it still has stopped both these countries from allowing a bigger bloc, a morally important bloc such as the European Union, from having a say in this Libyan crisis.
That was reporter Catherine Field in Paris. Well, South Korean President Moon Jae-in is meeting with U.S. President Donald Trump at the White House this hour. The two are expected to discuss how negotiations to end North Korea's nuclear program can move forward. North Korea has not carried out any nuclear test or missile launches in recent years. However, a meeting between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and Trump in Hanoi in February failed to produce a deal. Moon wants to bring new energy to talks between the North and the U.S. South Korea is seeking some easing of sanctions on North Korea to restart a joint industrial complex and to strengthen ties. The U.S. government and the United Nations are unwilling to ease sanctions unless North Korea clearly shows it is willing to limit its nuclear weapons program. This is VOA's International Edition.
Yes! Just say yes to the weekend. Hi, everybody. This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Let me help you maximize your weekend chill. If you tune into your local station this Sunday at 1505 or 2005 Universal Time and listen, I'll take you on a beautiful and fun-filled musical journey across the continent. This Sunday features music and news from Dogo du Togo, Mayonde, Ishan, Atot Manje, and more.
I just love everyone in Nairobi and want to send them love with this song.
So maximize your weekend, peeps. Listen to Music Time in Africa this Sunday and again the following Saturday at 1505 and 2005 Universal Time. Oh, yeah.
Well, for more than 65 years, the Washington Tennis and Education Foundation, WTEF, has offered children in undeserved neighborhoods access to tennis, which is often viewed as a sport for the wealthy. By combining athletic and academic tools, the foundation helps kids stay engaged and focused on their studies. Since opening in 1955, the organization has grown, but its mission has stayed the same, to give kids 8 to 18 years old the skills they need on the court and beyond. Amy Katz now writes the story.
After long hours at school, it's time for some fun. Andrea Nicholson, who comes almost every day, likes playing tennis.
Something that I like most about tennis is the game. Just really gets my attention in anything that I do. Just brings up the fire in me.
And backhand cross court.
Audra Bell helps bring out the best in children through her work with the Washington Tennis and Education Foundation.
A lot of times we go get them from school and bring them here. They do half their time doing homework and they spend time with tutors. We have a robotics program and a girls group.
The kids spend the rest of their time on the tennis court.
The kids are transformed whenever they commit and they learn discipline and they learn mental toughness and all of the things that tennis teaches you as a whole. It's really amazing to see.
You're on the court, you're playing singles, you're by yourself, you're relying on yourself. That is absolutely the exact same stamina and kind of resilience that our kids need in the classroom. We use it as the hook. They love it. They come every day and they play tennis. But we also expect them to excel academically. We also have two pros here that grew up in the program, and now they work here full-time as tennis coaches.
Beautiful.
Tennis director Mike Ragland is one of those pros. He says joining the program at 13 changed his life.
I was doing things I shouldn't have been doing. I got myself in a lot of trouble. When I started playing tennis, it gave me a different path to life.
Dante, watch that ball.
Because of tennis, Ragland went to college on a full scholarship and started a career as a tennis coach.
When they called and said that they was building this facility, they wanted someone to come back that came up through the program. I wanted to get back. We take the kids in. We talk to the kids about life, how to carry themselves, how to behave, and give them a structure, something that they can go forward with.
Oh, yeah!
It teaches you not to give up. And it teaches you just to kind of push through life. Everyone here is doing very well in school, and that's just all thanks to the tutors and the teachers that we have here.
Looking good.
Coaches here say just a few go on to become tennis pros, but others do very well and receive full scholarships, while the rest get a solid foundation to help them succeed in life. For writer Faiza El-Masri, Amy Katz, VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
On Wednesday, at a much-anticipated press conference held outside of Washington, D.C., Shepard Doleman, the director of the Event Horizon Telescope, announced a remarkable astronomical event.
And we are delighted to be able to report to you today that we have seen what we thought was unseeable. We have seen and taken a picture of a black hole.
This supermassive black hole with a mass equal to 6.5 billion suns lies at the heart of the Messier 87 galaxy, located 55 million light years away. The Event Horizon Telescope is really eight powerful radio telescopes located around the world that are joined together to form a giant virtual Earth-sized telescope. This astronomical breakthrough is detailed in a series of six papers published in a special issue of the Astrophysical Journal Letters. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Wojtek Zorniak. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams-Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.